Shrink Wrap Radio number 382, Healing Developmental Trauma with Dr. Lawrence Heller.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. Lawrence Heller about the approach he has developed for working with trauma. Lawrence Heller, PhD, is the founder of the Neuroaffective Relational Model, or NARM. He is the co-author of Crash Course, A Self-Healing Guide to Automobile Accident Trauma, with Diane Poole Heller, published in multiple languages, and the recent book Healing Developmental Trauma, How Early Trauma Affects Self-Regulation, Self-Image, and the Capacity for Relationship. This recent book, written with Aileen LaPierre, PsyD, has also been published in multiple languages. He was the founder of the Gestalt Institute of Denver, is a senior faculty member of the Somatic Experiencing Training Institute, and has been a clinician for over 30 years. He teaches all over the world and regularly in many countries in Europe. NARM is a neuroscientifically informed, somatically oriented, and psychodynamically informed approach for working with developmental trauma and works both top-down and bottom-up. He is currently teaching NARM in the U.S. and throughout Europe. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Lawrence Heller, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi, David. Glad to be here.
Well, you're the originator of an approach to treating trauma that you call the Neuroaffective Relational Model, or NARM. Right. And I was fascinated to read your book on that topic, and I'm really pleased to have you as a guest on the show today. Now, key to your theory are what you describe as five biologically based core needs: connection, attunement, trust, autonomy, and love-sexuality. Maybe you can take us through a bit of an overview of each of these.
Sure, and just to clarify too, is that my specific focus is on developmental trauma, and that was obviously the name of the book. And these are five developmental, what I call adaptive survival styles. And the names that you mentioned are the names of the missing or the compromised resources that result as a lack of environmental support, so that each one then has a particular kind of organizing principle and particular way of understanding, which many therapists in my trainings have found really helpful in terms of having a certain kind of clarity of what it is that they're dealing with. So I look at them as adaptive survival styles, but also organizing principles for understanding therapeutic work.
Okay. Well, let's go through them, as I say, somewhat briefly, just so that people have kind of got a sense of it. So the first one is connection.
So the missing or the compromised resource is, just as it says, it's connection. And what we see with that comes from the earliest kinds of trauma. And that can be early shock trauma, like very early surgeries, or it can come from early, very difficult attachment trauma, with, let's say, a mother who's profoundly depressed and unavailable, or a mother who's physically ill, or, you know, there are lots of different scenarios where you get really very early trauma. And the way then that individuals manage that is by disconnecting. They disconnect from bodily and emotional experience, and at the same time, they disconnect from social engagement or from other people. So it's connection. When I'm talking about connection, I'm talking about not just with the self, but the capacity to be in healthy relationship with other people. And that's what gets compromised with this earliest developmental trauma.
Okay, and the next one is attunement.
Right. So there again, these are chronologically based, so this tends to be a little bit later. You get the first survival style develops when there's perinatal trauma or trauma up to 6 months. If a person has had some kind of connection and then loses it, or if there is just a lack of attunement, then there's a way of, then this is a, this adaptive survival style is a way of dealing with that. So that, you know, what often happens is that there's an inadequate attunement to the child, and then the child never learns to self-regulate, never learns to attune to their own needs. One of the coping mechanisms is that they often become very good at attuning to other people's needs as part of this survival style. So we see many therapists, many people in the other helping professions tend to deal with this particular survival style. The paradox is that they're very attuned to other people's needs, but not so attuned to their own needs. So that's, again, that's the missing resource.
Okay. And then we have trust.
Right. This particular survival style develops in an atmosphere, again, where the feeling is that you can't let down, you can't trust. You get different kinds of childhood scenarios that end up being dealt with through this adaptive survival style, but where the child is ends up playing a role that's powerful in a certain way. They're rewarded, for example, for being their parents' best friend when that's not their job, but they're also rewarded for not paying attention to their own needs. You see this in scenarios where the child is used as a pawn between two struggling parents. Either they're divorcing or they're fighting in they're in relationship. So that the child ends up being used, and they end up getting a certain kind of gratification for this special role. And at the same time, they're being undermined to be authentic and true to what's real for them. You know, another very common scenario that I think your listeners will relate to too is that this survival style tends to develop, for example, when the child becomes the repository for the parent's dream. So this is like the classic example. This would be the stage mother or the soccer father or the sports father, who the parents who drive their child to fulfill their dreams. And so you see that they're kind of rewarded on a narcissistic level, they're rewarded on an ego level, but they're rewarded for selling themselves out in a certain way, and that's part of the paradox in working with this particular adaptive survival style.
And strangely, it's celebrated on reality TV these days. I don't know if you've seen some of these reality TV shows in which the stage moms are kind of the star, you know, as they push their kid through beauty pageants or other kinds of pageants.
Yeah, no, I actually haven't seen that. I travel a lot, so I don't get to see a lot of American TV, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, well, you're not missing anything in that way. The next one that you talk about is autonomy.
Right. So again, the missing or the compromised resource is the capacity for autonomy, the capacity to be able to set limits, to say no directly, to really show up in a relationship, particularly if showing up means dealing with conflict. These people with this adaptive survival style tend to be placators and peacemakers, and they tend to see themselves as quite flexible. But the difficulty is that they can all also at the same time be harboring deep resentment because they don't stand up for themselves, and they tend to blame others for that. But it creates all kinds of difficulties. They tend to be really nice and open-hearted people and good friends, but they're surprisingly difficult to work with in therapy because they're so compliant that they'll tend to want to adapt to whatever system the therapist seems to be representing, and they'll be the good client. But as they're being the good client and being compliant in this way, the resentment is starting to build in them. And so you get sometimes they'll sabotage you get a lot of different reactions. But it's despite the fact that they're very kind and open-hearted people, they're often very difficult for therapists to work with. I do a lot of supervisions with therapists just around this particular survival style.
Interesting. So I do sense a kind of age developmental progression here, as you suggest. And so we move on to the final one which you've described as love-sexuality.
Right. Yeah, again, we see that, so there are two resources, one or both of which can get compromised, and the relationship between the two can become compromised. So that, you know, in some families, it's just not safe to have an open heart, or the child's loving feelings are either ridiculed or attacked or undermined in different ways. We, of course, know that even in our sophisticated society, that a lot of people still have all kinds of difficulty with sexuality, so that they can be shamed again for their developing sexuality. And ultimately, the challenge for this particular survival style is to be able to integrate an open heart with a vital sexuality, which we know from, you know, from popular culture, from our own experience, from our work with clients, and that's not such always such an easy thing for us to do.
Yeah. Now, you talk about your approach, NARM, as being very integrative. And indeed, as we go through this, I'm hearing shades of attachment theory. It sounds like an elaboration on attachment theory, and which has its roots in psychodynamic theory.
Mm-hmm. I'm trained in both, you know, a number of different psychodynamic approaches as well as attachment theory. So you're right in hearing that, you know, there are these influences. There's, you know, I'm also on the faculty of the Somatic Experiencing Training Institute. So somatic experiencing is also part of my background. I was in the early years, not, it's been a long time, I did some training in bioenergetics and some of the other somatic psychology approaches. So I bring a lot of different elements to this work.
Yes, you do. Now, I seem to recall reading, just kind of in passing, there was a sentence to the effect that that we all suffer developmental trauma to some degree or another. Am I recalling that correctly?
Well, yeah. I mean, depending on how we, you know, there's certainly a broad spectrum, but I would say that very few of us escape childhood without some developmental trauma. You know, we go from the extremes of neglect and overt abuse to just certain kinds of misattunement. And so if we're including misattunement in, you know, under the category of developmental trauma, then I would say, yeah, we all experience some of that.
Uh-huh. So I guess the challenging devil's advocate kind of question that I would put to you around that is sort of two-pronged. One is, isn't that perhaps overextending the notion of trauma, and also doesn't that make it more or less equivalent to the term neurosis that we've used in the past?
Well, yeah, that's why I was being careful when I said if we include misattunement in there, mm-hmm. you know, because if we, you know, the classic kinds of what we would call, you know, neurotic reactions tend to be a result of, you know, inadequate mirroring or misattunement in different kinds of ways or distorted mirroring. So, yeah, I mean, I think that the word trauma can be fuzzy. It is very interesting though to me, and I think it's past due that in the DSM-5 now developmental trauma is included. So, but yeah, I think that sometimes we have to be careful about how we define our terms.
Okay. Now, your approach also emphasizes connection and aliveness. And aliveness, I hear your bioenergetic background. But I wanted to ask, well, why these two? I could imagine somebody else might come up with two other words that they thought were really important. So why connection and aliveness?
Well, when I'm use the word connection, I'm using it in the broadest possible sense. So that means connection to self and connection to others. So it's the and that each one of these adaptive survival styles respond to some kind of environmental failure, but even though they are life-saving and adaptive, they function in the long term by creating ongoing disconnection. So I see that this connection piece is really basic. As a matter of fact, the original title of the book was Connection, Our Deepest Desire and Greatest Fear, but then mm-hmm. the publisher said that's not a good Googleable title, so we had to change the title. And they were probably right. But this theme of connection is really basic, that so many of the symptoms that we as human beings experience have to do with difficulties in being connection to our own bodily and emotional experience, and in being in healthy connection and relationship with other people. So there certainly are strong elements of attachment theory that come in, and part of how I see the book and the trainings that I do is building a bridge between attachment understanding and the somatic psychotherapy world, because I think that it's a missing link that we're seeing is that and so my hope is to be able to shed some light on the connection between attachment and somatic processes.
Yes, and what about that other word, aliveness?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. It's not used to traditionally in psychology, and yet. What I've come to see, having been a clinician for over 35 years, is that really that is so much of what people are seeking, is that they're seeking, of course they're seeking regulation, they're seeking connection, but on some deep level they're seeking a connection to that deep vitality that gives life meaning. And that so often you see is that, you know, that we get depressed, for example, when we are disconnected from that vitality or that aliveness, and we get other kinds of symptoms as well. So I see it as an organizing principle that people seem to respond to, and it's not pathologizing in the sense that we're, and NARM is really a non-pathologizing oriented approach, in the sense that we're not looking at, diagnosing people in a pathological way. But when we talk about disconnection from aliveness, people tend to respond very positively to that.
Yes, yes. Now, you mentioned that you're a somatic experiencing senior trainer. Mm-hmm. How does NARM differ from or build upon sensory or somatic experiencing?
Well, NARM very much uses the really powerful tools that are there in somatic experiencing as part of the NARM approach. As you undoubtedly read, NARM functions both bottom-up and top-down. Now, somatic experiencing is primarily a bottom-up approach. It works incredibly well with shock trauma, where, but when there is significant developmental trauma, you get distortion of identity in addition to profound autonomic nervous system dysregulation. So by integrating top-down approaches, which include, various psychodynamic understandings and various other approaches that address identity, along with somatic experiencing and the focus on the re-regulation of the nervous system, you move from what we call in NARM a distress cycle, which is this continuous feedback loop between distortions of identity and dysregulations in the nervous system. By being able to address both the top-down distortions and the bottom-up dysregulation, we have a powerful tool.
Okay, now I'm still not totally clear on the distinction between top-down and bottom-up.
Well, somatic experiencing works ultimately it's based on the idea that when there's shock trauma, there's the mobilization of these energies of fight and flight, and that these are very powerful survival energies, and that when these survival energies are not able to be completed, they get held in the body in the form of bracing and collapse and physiological symptoms. And so the job is to, the orientation is to work bottom up to help, it's really working with the brainstem, the so-called reptilian brain, to complete these fight-flight responses. And as those fight-flight responses are completed, then people get significantly less symptomatic. That's the bottom-up piece.
So bottom-up is essentially working with the body.
working with a body orientation is sometimes means hands-on work, but it doesn't have to mean. It can mean just being bringing awareness to the body, so that people, listeners, don't get confused. It's not just a touch approach, although touch therapists use SE as well.
Yes. Okay. So that's bottom up, and then top down would be what, more of a psychological approach, approach.
Yeah, well, integrating issues of identity distortion, in NARM I talk about shame and pride-based identifications and how they function and how we can work with those for ourselves and how we can work with those with our clients, and how the functional unity and the interplay between these identity distortions and dysregulation in the nervous system and how one reinforces the other. That's that distress cycle that I mentioned.
Okay. Now, you also emphasize somatic mindfulness. And I've sometimes joked that we seem to be in a mindfulness bubble, in as much as so many books and workshops seem to have mindfulness somewhere in their title or description. So how is somatic mindfulness different than Vipassana meditation? And why is it an important component in the treatment of trauma?
Well, one is that I think that, partly we are in this, I don't know about a bubble, but we're certainly riding a wave of interest in mindfulness because it's such a powerful tool. And if you compare what I'm talking about in terms of somatic mindfulness with, let's say, your question, which was about Vipassana, is that Vipassana talks about a kind of an even-handed awareness towards all experience. Now, for some people who haven't had significant developmental trauma, that's more possible. But if you've had very early trauma, particularly like this first developmental survival style, the connection survival style, you've got so much identity distortion and so much autonomic dysregulation that to be able to just try and stay present to your experience is often overwhelming. And I've consulted with many different meditation lead teachers and groups about, why sometimes when people go on a 5-day retreat doing Vipassana or other kinds of meditation, they'll get in panic attacks, because one of the ways that we attempt to regulate ourselves is through motor activity. And when we don't have that, when we just sit for days and days and days, are just with ourselves, for some people, it's just too overwhelming. And then they end up feeling bad about themselves because they couldn't do it or because they had a panic attack. And so the somatic mindfulness integrates some of the somatic experiencing tools like that we need to titrate. We need to take difficult experiences just one little piece at a time. We pendulate back and forth between organizing experiences and the disorganization and dysregulation that's there. So somatic mindfulness integrates that, and in that way separates itself from some of the other kind of more classic mindfulness approaches.
Great. And you mentioned the non-pathologizing attitude, and coming out of the existential humanistic tradition myself, I've been very interested in the positive psychology movement, and so I also appreciate the stress you place on an orientation toward personal strengths and increasing the capacity for self-regulation. Maybe you can expand on that a bit, and particularly in relation to self-regulation, what exactly are we talking about regulating?
Well, we usually focus on the nervous system, but ultimately, I think we talk about, helping the nervous system regulate, particularly the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and parasympathetic branches of the autonomic nervous system, because they're the most addressable through talk and touch, as opposed to the endocrine system and neurotransmitters, which tend to be more responsive to medications and addressable through medication. But we can actually help people learn how to regulate their nervous system, which then has a cascading influence that, of course, when you're regulating the nervous system, you're getting regulation of neurotransmitters, you're getting regulation on the endocrine system level, you're really getting regulation on all levels of experience. So we focus on that nervous system piece because in some ways it's the most easily addressable.
Now, in the course of our discussion here, a couple of times you referred not only to developmental trauma, but also to what you call shock trauma. So say a little bit more about what the difference is between those two, if you will.
Well, developmental trauma, you know, and maybe it would be better to even talk about developmental slash relational trauma versus shock trauma. Mm-hmm. But shock trauma is easier to define in the sense that shock trauma is like a can be like a single event, like a surgery, an auto accident, being robbed, being raped. Those are shock trauma events where unless there was some family member perpetrator, those kinds of shock trauma are more easily addressable by a bottom-up approach. But when you've got a relational element, for example, when the parents are the abusers, it's not so easy just to complete fight flight when the child or even the adult with still coming from a child's consciousness needs to protect the attachment relationship with the parent. And so you can't just work on a nervous system level when there's relational trauma, when the parents were abusers or when they were the neglectors or even when there was profound misattunement. So that's an important distinction that I make between working with shock trauma versus working with developmental or relational trauma.
Okay, thank you. Now, we've talked about your approach being integrative, which I truly think it is and something I really admire about what you're doing. I'm wondering how or if it incorporates elements of other current approaches that deal with trauma, such as EMDR, prolonged exposure therapy, cognitive processing therapy.
Well, of the ones that you mentioned, certainly there are cognitive elements in terms of when you're working with identity distortion, having some of the tools that are available through cognitive work are quite helpful. It doesn't integrate EMDR, although many people who have studied EMDR have found ways to integrate NARM into their EMDR practice. Mm-hmm. In a way, it's just the opposite of exposure therapy. So that's at the other end of the continuum. I wouldn't consider NARM to be at all influenced by exposure therapy.
Mm-hmm. You know, I just happened to come across a new title by Philip Zimbardo that is on trauma, mm-hmm. and I have no idea what he's up to. Do you know what he addresses in that book? Is he?
If it's a new book, I don't know. I have read, but it's been some time. I've read something that he's written, but I'm not fluent in whatever. Certainly, I don't know what his new book is about.
Okay, it's kind of an unfair question, but I thought you might know. I'm going to have to look into that on my own. So, what's the role of catharsis in NARM?
NARM. Well, again, maybe it's important to define our terms, but I define NARM as a non-cathartic oriented therapy. It's more around learning how to contain and deepen affect. That doesn't mean, though, that we discourage people from having deep emotions, but it's what is clear in NARM is that what I don't encourage is abreaction, where people lose kind of revert back to childhood situations, relive them. In my experience, that's not so helpful in terms of renegotiating trauma. There's much more of a possibility with abreaction, and catharsis is often part of that, that the client can get re-traumatized. So I always talk about it when I'm teaching in the various trainings that I do on NARM, the importance of helping the client always keep one foot in the here and now. And the somatic mindfulness piece is one of the tools that I use that we're never focusing more on the past than on the present experience. You know, you mentioned before we talked about your connection with Gestalt in early years, and NARM too. Gestalt was, I think, the very first, at least, widespread phenomenological therapy that really focused on what people are experiencing in the moment. And NARM is also very much that way. It's like we're really emphasizing what's going on right now and how are we distorting our experience in the present moment. How do the persistence of adaptive survival styles, that how do they distort our experience in the present moment? So in a sense, it's a shift from the psychodynamic model too, in that it's not an approach that says what we are today is the result of what happened 25 years ago. We're saying that some things happened 25 years ago, and those, you know, let's say developmental trauma, we then developed adaptive survival styles to deal with those, and it's the persistence of those survival styles that distorts present experience. So it's a very much a here and now approach, even though we don't ignore personal history by any means, but it's still that one foot in the here and now is so important.
Yeah, and I can see the here and now emphasis being connected with Gestalt. At the same time, I have the sense that maybe you might have evolved away from Gestalt a bit, because I think, at least as I saw it demonstrated by Pearls and others, there was kind of a lot of emotional catharsis. And when you talk, I hear you talk about titrating and pendulating, you know, moving between emotional intensity and backing off of it, is the impression that I get.
That's absolutely right, Aaron. I mean, from the perspective of the way Pearls and some of the people worked in Gestalt back then, it's quite different. We used to use batakas and, you know,
yes, right,
beat pillows. And I joke with my trainees, there's no pillow abuse in NARMS.
Right. I came up on that. Now, I'm wondering if you're familiar with recent work on memory reconsolidation, suggesting that there's a window in which the emotional impact of traumatic experience can be more or less reprogrammed.
I've read some of those articles. I'm somewhat skeptical. I need to be convinced, because so much of what goes on in trauma is really in the body and in implicit memory. So, you know, I would need to understand more to make an informed opinion about it, but, you know, of course, you know, I'm open to anything that might work. But when we're just talking about explicit memory, you know, memory that's mediated through the hippocampus, for example, that's one thing. But so much of particularly developmental trauma and even shock trauma ends up being implicitly held in the deeper structures of the brain and in the body, in a way that my question is, and I don't have enough information to know for certain, you know, is this going to be as effective as people hope it will be?
Yeah, I guess what's behind my question is kind of a speculation that maybe that's part of what would be at play in the effectiveness of your approach. But probably neither one of us understands enough about that research to speak with any authority on it.
Well, maybe I was, you know, talking specifically about that there are certain kinds of medications that if you give it immediately after trauma, that's what I was thinking. Maybe you're talking about something else.
No, I'm thinking of that there is a point in the – what's been asserted is that there is a point in the kind of emotional reliving and release of that, where it's possible to kind of to disassociate the negative emotion that was linked to that experience.
I read a little bit about that, but I don't have enough knowledge to have an informed opinion at this point.
Well, good for you for fessing up. Now, speaking of research, is there any research support for NARM, or is it kind of too young?
It's kind of too young, but the interesting thing we've got, in the last few months, a neurologist has volunteered to actually, because she was very excited by the book, and she's basically volunteered her services. So we're planning on in the next year to actually have some evidence-based studies that we'll have, you know, hopefully available in the not-too-distant future as NARM continues to develop and the trainings expand in various places.
Excellent. So if I were a fly on the wall during an ARM session, and I know you kind of have a chapter on this, what would one see? What would one hear? Give us a sense of what the sessions go like.
Well, it's it's not, I mean, yeah, I've got to be careful because sometimes if I say something, people might take it further than I intend. But it's very much here and now oriented. So it's, for example, part of the process is learning to be able to track your experience, both emotional experience and the sensations in your body in the here and now. So it's often starting there. Like with any other therapy, I begin with what is it that people are looking for, and which is an important part of what I teach, that it's important to have a clear contract, a clear understanding of what it is, at least, that the client is wanting from the therapy. Doesn't mean that we always have to accept that, but it's important to have that clear contract. Then we start looking at symptoms. That's often a very useful place to start, and that symptoms are often like roadmaps to areas of disconnection, you know, and then we work with the relationship to the resources that are disconnected. So, for example, somebody comes in and they're complaining that, you know, everybody takes advantage of them and, they try to be flexible and nice and so they're into saying people at work just won't take no for an answer. And then I would bring it back with the right timing, of course, as we need to do always in therapy, to their difficulty in setting limits so that they're not just seeing themselves as victims of their environment, but as seeing their part. That's what I call agency in ARM. Responsibility is a word that has sometimes negative connotations, but that we are actors in our own story, and that what is it that we do, and the fact that ultimately we can see that we even train people to in certain ways not to take us seriously, or to if we never say no, then people will have a tendency to ask all kinds of things of us, and then you get in this vicious cycle. So we're exploring these patterns of coping that people have developed, which create the symptoms in their life. And when appropriate, of course, we look at the historical context, what were the developmental traumas that they've experienced, but we don't make that the primary focus, what happened in the past. We don't ignore it, but it isn't become like what I call an archaeological dig.
Mm-hmm. What about transference? Does that play any role in the work that you do?
Yeah, of course. Transference is, from my perspective at least, is a pretty universal phenomenon. And exploring, and transference is one of the ways that we can explore how these adaptive survival styles are expressing themselves in the here and now, by exploring how they're expressing themselves in the relationship. Now, on the other hand, I do want to say, because this is, I think, an important distinction, is that working with people, particularly with what I call the connection survival style, that a premature focus on the transference relationship can actually be re-traumatizing for them when they never got the basics of self-regulation. That was, autonomic regulation is one of the very earliest developmental tasks that an attuned mother provides for her, or attuned caretaker in some cases, but that they provide for their child. And if that piece is missing because there was early trauma of whatever kind, then premature focus on the attachment relationship, the transference relationship, can actually be re-traumatizing for some people. So I wanted to just put that little caveat in there.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it varies, but do you have any sense of the kind of the average length of time that you would work with people?
Yeah, again, it does vary. It depends on really what people want and what their how long they've been struggling, the depth of their struggle. So, it could be as short as 3 months or as long as several years. It's with you know, it's hard for me to be any more precise.
Well, in that regard, it really is in tune with psychodynamic therapy, and so it's not making any sort of magic bullet claim.
No, it's not. It's not. You know, we're talking about people who have had, you know, developmental trauma where there, you know, been significant impact on their whole relationship to self and their whole internal world. Mm-hmm. You know, just solution for focused work from my perspective when dealing with that kind of trauma isn't enough.
Well, I'm wondering what led to this transition. Here you are working as a senior trainer for somatic experiencing, which is kind of more focused and discreet in a way, I would imagine. And but then somehow you transition into this sort of more broad, encompassing kind of work. Can you say anything about what it was in you or your life that kind of moved you in that direction?
Well, that's actually the what I'm now calling NARM has been part of my work forever as well. So that I became intrigued by Peter Levine's work in the late 80s and saw that he had really developed some unique tools for working with what we're now calling, you know, autonomic nervous system dysregulation. And I was fascinated by it, and I thought this was really valuable. But I never actually stopped working on, you know, my big interest, which is developmental trauma. So they've been running parallel now. So for years I've been running special seminars in, you know, various topics like shame and guilt and many, many other topics which were NARM topics. But it's only in the last few years that I've started NARM training program, a 2-year clinical training program. We've got, you know, I'm here in Los Angeles. I live here in Los Angeles. I'm here. I've got a training program going here now. We've got one starting in the San Francisco area after the first year, another one starting in Los Angeles. I've got trainings in Denmark and Switzerland and Germany and the Netherlands. So, and I've been doing certain kinds of trainings in these areas for a long time, but it's now only in the last few years that this 2-year clinical training program has come together.
Okay, so you have a specific 2-year program that we might have some listeners that would be interested mm-hmm. in that. So maybe you can just say a bit more about the structure of that and what kinds of people would qualify to take part in that training.
Yeah, it's oriented towards psychotherapists. It's you don't have to have had a somatic background, including somatic experiencing, but it's helpful that if people have some kind of somatic background, sensory motor, some somatic experiencing, or some of the other somatic psychotherapies, because it is a somatically oriented therapy. But we focus on teaching the basic tools and techniques that I presented in the book to, you know, helping therapists learn how to use those tools specifically in their practice. And as I said, it's 2 years, and it's depending on where it's in the States, it's 4 days, 3 times a year. In Europe, it's 5 days twice a year. For 2 years. So, and there's certain, you know, personal work that's required and certain supervisions. But it's a training program designed to help people integrate and utilize these tools.
Okay. Now, you did write an earlier book titled Crash Course about shock trauma, which we've mentioned several times in the course of our discussion here. Uh-huh. So maybe you can just tell us a bit about the treatment approach advocated in that book.
Well, that book was written very strongly in the somatic experiencing tradition, because somatic experiencing is really, from my perspective, the most powerful tools that we have for working with that kind of shock trauma. It was the book came out of a work that Diane Poolheller and I were doing at the time in Colorado, and it was kind of by, you know, came about indirectly, is that we started working with some people with who had been symptomatic from automobile accidents for a long time. And we started having a tremendous amount of success. And the insurance companies started noticing that. And one actually wanted to fund a study. But we did, I'm sure we saw hundreds of people with auto accidents over a many-year period. And we thought, and we started to see just how, what a huge impact automobile accidents have on people's lives. You know, it's just about everybody has either been in one or knows someone. And there's so much unrecognized trauma that we thought it would be really helpful to write a book that was more oriented. I mean, it was designed to help therapists, but it was really designed also for the general public, so that people who've been in auto accidents and then ended up having sleep disturbances and panic attacks and all kinds of other things could begin to understand what was going on in their, particularly in their nervous systems. And so that's, that book came out of that, that experience. And it's been around now. The book's been around for 10 years. It's amazing that every year it sells a little bit more. So it speaks to the ongoing need out there.
Have you heard from readers?
We've heard from hundreds and hundreds of readers. You know, that, you know, so often, after even what seems like a relatively minor accident, people have these tremendous reactions, and that we've heard from so many people saying, you know, for the first time, somebody finally gets what I've been going through. You know, it's like and expressing, you know, relief and gratitude just to understand that they're not crazy. Because when you get autonomic nervous system dysregulation, which is what happens after an auto accident, you know, you get these ups and downs where you know, you're at one point you're dissociated and shut down and frozen, then there will be a certain trigger, and then you've got this high activation, and that gets to be unbearable, and then you shut down again and go into freeze and dissociation. And so it feels like an inner roller coaster that many people have ridden. Now, of course, not just from automobile accidents, but from all kinds of shock trauma. So we've gotten, you know, a lot of people who said how helpful it was just that, you know, somebody finally could help them understand what it was that they were going through.
Yeah, I really resonate to that as I hear you talk about it, and the kind of energy and excitement that comes into your voice. And I've been in some automobile accidents. I haven't, I'm not aware of any lasting sequelae, but I certainly get excited as I hear you talk about it. So I might have to think about that some more.
Well, you know, it's easy to, you know, there are easy ways to find out if there's anything left over.
Yeah, how's that?
I don't want to suggest that and then maybe have people re-traumatize themselves, but you can just bring up one single frame from the event and just track what happens in your body. And if you find that there's a certain kind of arousal, or what we call activation, if you start to feel activated in your body, that tells you that there's probably something unresolved that's left over. So, yeah, I mean, it's like I had a guy, I did a talk one time years ago, and he had been in an avalanche where there, you know, this was, I think, in Nepal or something like that, and there were 16 people, and of those 16 people, eight people didn't survive. And he said to me, but I have no, there's nothing left over from that. I mean, I'm fine. And I said, well, just bring up an image of a snowfield and notice what you feel in your body. And he did that, and he had this shudder, and he realized that sometimes you see that we can disconnect from what's really going on. And by just bringing up this image and tracking what he was experiencing in his body, he saw, no, wait a minute, there is a lot here that I didn't realize. So
let's talk a little bit about the military situation, where PTSD is like a huge, you know, a huge thing in our society, with all these people coming back from having served abroad and under horrendous circumstances. There was recently a 60-minute show. I'm giving away how much TV I watch, but on 60 Minutes, they did a profile of a program working with vets in the VA, because the VA, this is a huge thing. They've got to come up with, you know, the best practices and the most effective practices that they can. Well, they did not mention somatic experiencing. So I'm wondering, you know, why isn't that more visible maybe than it is in the VA, or is it more visible and I'm just not seeing it?
Well, I do know there were a bunch of people who were my students on the East Coast in the Silver Spring area who integrated Oriental medicine with somatic experiencing and were doing it in Walter Reed and having a great deal of success. I think it's unfortunate that they haven't gotten, it was clearly acknowledged and recognized, and as far as I know, it's been a few years since I've been back out there, but that program is ongoing and they've done very well. Why it's not gotten more publicity, that's a question I can't answer.
Yeah, and that kind of thing is often as political as anything else.
Yeah.
Well, I've kind of gone through all my questions here. I wonder if there's anything that we haven't touched on that you'd want to say.
Oh, well, that's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things that I mentioned about NARM and applying this to developmental trauma is that it's resource-oriented, which means, and it relates to the positive psychology piece that you mentioned earlier, is that we don't just focus on what went wrong. And, you know, it's like, and we don't just focus on history, you know, because there's a meta process that goes on in therapies, is that if we can become experts at focusing on what went wrong, it doesn't mean that we avoid that either. But we also focus on, you know, the strengths, the inner wisdom that help people to survive sometimes unbelievably difficult developmental situations, and yet here they are and they've made it. So it's important, that would be an important piece that I want to add, is that it's dealing with the pain and the difficulties in ways that are manageable, but it's also not forgetting about a certain focus on reflecting the strengths that people have and the resiliency that people have, and in supporting people's increasing resiliency.
Well, that's a good note for us to close on then, a nice upbeat note. So, Dr. Lawrence Heller, I want to thank you for taking time to be my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio today.
Well, thank you, David. It was nice to talk with you.
Connection and aliveness. I'm still struck by those two terms as interesting pegs upon which to hang a theory of mental health. I can certainly see how the idea of connection has evolved out of attachment theory. And I see the roots of aliveness in the work of Wilhelm Reich and all the body therapists who have followed in his wake. Personally, I think it's greater aliveness that resonates most strongly for me. There is this part of me that longs for the intensity and aliveness of youth. I think that quest is at the heart of at least some spiritual disciplines, as well as for many who seek out psychedelic experiences through drugs or other practices. At the same time, for myself, I'm aware of a rhythm of moving toward and moving away. At times I want connection, and then I need space just as badly as I needed connection. And similarly, there are times when I'm drawn to the intensity of a greater experience of aliveness, followed by the need for retreat and restoration. This is not to deny Dr. Heller's insights. These are just my reflections toward the end of the day, the interview having been conducted many hours earlier. So even these reflections bear the mark of the biorhythm of the day. And I certainly can't argue with his five biologically based core needs: connection, attunement, trust, autonomy, and love, sexuality. They do make sense from a psychodynamic and attachment theory point of view. I have to applaud Dr. Heller's very integrated synthesis. It's clear to see how his thinking has evolved out of his own history, training, and experience with a number of therapeutic modalities. He's reorganized that information into a schema that brings sense and direction to therapeutic intervention. And as far as I can tell, his approach does not do violence to the converging insights we've been hearing from other major theorists over the course of these interviews. As you heard, he's not promising overnight miracle cures or a silver bullet. And I especially like his non-pathologizing approach. and his determination to identify and build upon the client's inner resources and strengths, while at the same time not denying the painful symptoms and difficulties to be overcome. Consequently, it's not surprising that his workshops are in great demand around the country and that his two books have been translated into multiple languages. I think that the book we focused most on in our interview, Healing Developmental Trauma, will have particular appeal to seasoned therapists who are looking to deepen their work and understanding. I think his earlier book, Crash Course, will have a strong appeal to all out there, especially those who have experienced an automobile accident or other sort of shock trauma. And as always, you're invited to order these books using our Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on the Shrink Wrap Radio website.
Hi guys, my name is Tony. I'm from Melbourne, Australia, and I just signed up to become a monthly donator to Shrink Wrap Radio. And I did this because I love this podcast series. It gives me so much every single time I listen to these episodes, and I just wanted to give something back. I think it's important that when you find something that's pure of heart and honest in its intent and generous in its spirit, that you get behind and support it to ensure that it continues. And that's what I've done, and I encourage you all to do the same. Get on board, donate, put your hands in your pockets, stand up. It feels good. It's important. Thanks.
Tony, thank you so much for that impassioned appeal for others to join you as a financial supporter of Shrink Wrap Radio. As some of you understand, producing this podcast has become pretty much a 7 days a week effort on my part. Not that I'm spending all day every day, but it's a rare day that I'm not spending some hours on one aspect of the enterprise or another. The download statistics make it clear that a great many more people are listening to this podcast than help to support it. That's why I've created what I'm calling the guilt-free or good karma option of $12 a year, which comes out to a mere 25 cents per episode, plus access to all the past interviews, 381 of them, plus all the transcripts. Aren't these interviews worth at least 25 cents each? You know they are. Donate today and get your name on the honor roll, which you'll find when you mouse over the support tab, and I'll thank you in advance. Now, switching topics, I was interviewed recently by podcaster Brett Bernhoft on his podcast, and if you're interested, you should be able to find it at bipolarness.com. That's bipolarness.com. If you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for any length of time, you know that I used to play a brief excerpt of the interview at the beginning of the show and then follow with something along the lines of, that was the voice of, you know, Dr. So-and-so. So among radio professionals, this is known as a billboard. I thought it was a cool thing to do when I first learned about it. I thought it would give the listener an idea of what to expect and hopefully whet his or her appetite for more. Well, after doing this for a few years, I got some advice from a terrestrial radio expert who said I was taking too long to get into the actual interviews, and that I should not give all the background on the interviewee, and what I should do basically would be to say something along the lines of, I'll be talking with Dr. X today about XYZ, and now on to the interview. Just get right to it quickly before people got bored. So I started doing that, and then I heard from listener and guest Sarah Hannah Radcliffe letting me know that she really missed the more detailed biographical background on the guests. So I went back to doing that part of it. Well, now I've heard from listener and friend Oscar in Stockholm that he really misses the billboard, that 1 or 2 minute excerpt from the interview to come. And he suggested I put the question to my listenership. So I've just now installed a polling piece of software on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, and I'd really like you to go to shrinkwrapradio.com and find the poll in the right-hand sidebar. You'll have to scroll way down until you see It's right under the little box ad for Stitcher. And it says Yop Poll. That's Y-O-P. I don't know what the Y-O-P stands for. I guess it's the name of the company providing the polling software. At any rate, it asks you if you want the billboard to come back, yes, no, or you're fine either way. Creating the billboard does mean a little bit more work for me, but I'm fine going back to it if that's the way the vote turns out. So please do take the time to vote so that I'll know your preference in the matter.
Just sit back and unwind. It's all in your mind, don't you know? This is Shrink Wrap Radio. Oh, if it's knowledge that you crave, well then listen to Dr. Dave, don't you know? This is Shrink Wrap Radio. Oh, Shrink Wrap Radio. Oh, Shrink Wrap Radio.
Sweet. Thank you, Tony in Melbourne, who also made the financial appeal in the previous segment. Tony, you can bet I'll want to keep that as part of the Shrink Wrap Radio musical collection for use from time to time. Feel free to send me any more inspirations like that, Tony, or any other musicians out there. You should also feel very welcome to do similarly. Now let's hear some recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Mike near Dublin, Ireland, who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Warm wishes from Ireland. I wanted to write to thank you very much for your work on Shrink Wrap Radio. I've been an avid listener for the last few months and decided this morning to take the plunge and support your tremendous work by becoming a monthly donor to what I believe is a really excellent resource. I hope my jumbo monthly contribution goes in some small way to demonstrate my gratitude for your hard work and continued investment in bringing a diverse, informative, and educative range of ideas, themes, and thoughts to the discourse on psychology and counseling. As an accredited psychotherapist based here in Ireland, I find that I listen most to your podcasts on my way to and from my office as a means of shifting me into a counseling/psychological mindset and also to keep me informed on the latest and greatest ideas in the world of psychology. As a result, listening has become part of my weekly practice. In particular, your recent interview, number 337, with Dr. Christopher Soten on using dreams in healthcare was fascinating and inspired me to go out and purchase Dr. Soten's book, which I have come to believe is one of the best recent books on the subject of applied dream work. Thank you for bringing Dr. Soten's work to our collective attention. Interestingly, both yourself and Dr. Soten made several references to dream groups in your interview, but on searching through the hundreds of podcasts now on Shrink Wrap Radio, I have failed to find a single one on the topic of dream groups or even a reference to the dream appreciation group method developed by Montague Ullman, now deceased. I wonder if this is an oversight of mine or if this has ever crossed your mind as a topic for a future show. Well, Dr. Dave, thanks again for producing wonderful interviews and bringing such a tremendous wealth of information and insight into the profession as diverse as it is around the world. I look forward to catching up on the most recent podcasts and contributing to the future of Shrink Wrap Radio. With kindest regards, that's from Mike Hackett, PMP, ARCHTI, and MIACP. And all of that, I guess, stands for Accredited Therapist, Diplomate in Counseling, Bachelor of Science, Honors, Counseling, and Psychotherapy. Well, Mike, I so much appreciate your letter and your financial support. And I will be passing your letter on, I hope you won't mind, to Dr. Soton. I think he'll be very pleased by it. I can't even remember if I'm pronouncing his name correctly now, if it was Soton or Soton. I think it's Soton. It's been a while since I did that interview and since I've seen him. Although I may see him again soon if I end up going to the annual International Association for the Study of Dreams conference, which is happening in Berkeley, California, in this coming June. And so I'll be saying more about that in future shows. I'll be advertising that a bit. And also, I will be seeing Dr. Jeremy Taylor there, whom I recommended to Mike because I did an interview with him where he talks at some length and very specifically about what he calls projective group dream work. And I sent a link to that to Mike. I'm not looking it up right now because I want to keep recording, but I think it was like maybe number 51. It was a fairly early interview, but a really good one if I do say so myself. So thanks again, Mike. And with that, I will move on. Next, we hear from social worker David Rodasil, who writes, "Wow, thank you for the expedient reply, Dr. Dave. I myself have been involved with NAMI as a teacher for both family members of someone with a major mental illness and to mental health providers working with individuals with mental illness and their families." So NAMI is N-A-M-I, and it stands for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He goes on to say, "Having a brother with schizophrenia pushed me to discover the supportive network of NAMI at a time when I had more questions than answers. Small soapbox segue. I was telling a colleague today how odd I find it that thought disorders are considered to be one of the most gravely disabling illnesses, and yet the public awareness is almost zilch. There's Pink for Breast Cancer Month, Movember for Testicular Cancer, and great awareness surrounding Alzheimer's. Anyway, that's enough from me. I'd love to share my story as I feel it resonates with so many, both clinicians and family members. I imagine you're a popular man. Warm regards, David Rodasil and ACSW-MSW. I think David is offering his services potentially as a guest. I did interview someone about NAMI some years ago in my Wise Counsel podcast series, but I'm sure it would be good to interview David, so I've added him to my long and growing list as a possible interviewee. And I've not done a whole lot on schizophrenia either, and so that would be another reason to elevate him a bit on that list. Finally, here's one more from Phil in the UK who writes, "Dr. Dave, I donated $15 because you did a program about pot. In 2011, I wrote to ask about this. Read below." And indeed, he did write me back in 2011. He says, "The podcast didn't cover the topic in detail, but now you have broken the ground and perhaps there is a chance for more in the future." Phil, I am going to have a guest on soon who will be speaking in depth about psychedelics, I believe. He's one of the early pioneers in the area. And so that'll be coming up in January, so keep your ears tuned to this internet location for my interview with Dr. Ralph Metzner. And hopefully you will be pleased. So I think that better wrap it up for today. And always, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave messages on my message machine at 206-350-9918. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Lawrence Heller, for sharing his work on NARM and trauma. And on the next episode, I'll be speaking with Dr. Pieter Roussau about his extensive work in the emerging and burgeoning field of neuropsychotherapy. So until then, this is Dr. Dave once again saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.